Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, Julie Kelly joins us to unpack the latest of the January 6th investigation. And will Trump be indicted? She joins us to unpack that. Get your tickets to America Fest today at amfest.com. That's amfest.com. And Steve Cortez gives us an economic update. And we dive into, what is this rail strike that is looming? Get involved with Turning Point USA today at tpusa.com. Start a high school chapter, start a college chapter today, and get your tickets to America Fest, amfest.com. Biggest speakers in the movement, December 17, 18, 19, 20 in Phoenix, Arizona. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For personalized loan services you can count on, go to andrewandtodd.com, the wonderful andrewandtodd.com. Steve Cortez joins us now. Steve, welcome back to the program. Steve, walk us through the looming rail strike in America.
Now, Charlie, listen, this is an incredibly significant issue and a massive economic risk that this country certainly does not need at a time like this. And I mean at a time like this because the economy is already in tatters. It is already careening into a ditch, largely because of the inflation that was unleashed by Joe Biden, which is a created crisis from his misbegotten policies, his complete mismanagement of the U.S. economy. Now add in right in front of the holidays, right in front of, at least for retail, the most significant economic few weeks of the year, a potential catastrophic rail strike. About one third of all goods in America are shipped by rail, so it's hard to overstate the scope of this. One of the things politically that I find fascinating about this is that Joe Biden claimed he was going to be the most pro-union president ever. Well, he does love public sector unions, which of course are completely beholden by the Democratic Party, but private sector unions, which are mostly aligned with the Democratic Party, but not nearly as slavishly as the public sector unions, turns out he's not as interested there. And even moreover, you know, whether or not he's pro or anti-union is the fact that he's simply not taking a direct enough role in trying to fix this situation. You know, back in 1902, Teddy Roosevelt, which was really, I think, one of the moments that made him the great statesman that we now regard him as very properly. So in 1902, there was a coal strike that was threatening America, kind of similar timing into winter, just as it was getting cold. The results could have been catastrophic for the United States. He gathered all of the interested parties, the owners, the miners, others, the press, everybody into rooms and insisted on personally leading the negotiation until he could reach a settlement, which he indeed did. We need to see that kind of leadership now. We're not seeing it, of course, from Joe Biden. I'm not sure he's even cognitively able to lead that kind of intense negotiation. But the fact of the matter is, this is a significant, possible, massive disruption to the U.S. economy. And again, at a time that the economy is in terrible shape anyway and cannot sustain this kind of an economic headshot, given the already weakened state because of what Biden has wrought.
Yeah. So, but can you just kind of go through, if you were, let's just say if you were in arbitration with the two parties, what is the main sticking point right now? What is actually being debated or discussed, or what is in contention?
Right. Right now, most of the details revolve around paid sick leave. And look, in my view, and I don't know all of the details, and we don't know what has been negotiated, of course, behind closed doors. But in my view, the demands of the miners, or excuse me, of the railroad workers in this case, are actually are pretty just and are pretty reasonable. But you know, regardless, again, the point here is that clearly a solution could be reached. What it takes is the will to reach it, and it takes the leadership and negotiation skills of somebody, particularly the President of the United States, to be willing to exert his influence, his authority. And again, this is the problem of having somebody like Joe Biden in office, somebody who is incapable of executing the tasks of the hardest job in the world, somebody who post-election, I think, frankly, doesn't care very much post-midterm election, you know, is frankly indifferent to the plight of the American economy, the plight of the railroad workers, the plight, for that matter, of any stakeholders in this situation. And basically every American is really a stakeholder here. So this is let me put on top of this, you know, another aspect that is crucial. Joe Biden has already decimated the transportation industry in general through his attacks on American energy. So the fact that Joe Biden immediately upon taking office declared war on American energy production, on the domestic, affordable, dependable flow of energy from our own ground, from our own land that was so facilitated by Donald Trump. And we became not just energy independent, but in fact, energy dominant. He killed that golden goose almost immediately. The consequences for inflation have been incredibly severe, but particularly so for the transportation industry, which, of course, needs this fuel quite literally to move things. Mm-hmm. And we see it in not just in the rails, but, for example, in the trucking industry. The trucking industry has been decimated lately. It is extremely difficult for trucking companies to turn a profit, difficult for them to find workers. The vaccine mandates were particularly onerous for this business and sent a lot of truckers out of that business on a permanent basis because of what Joe Biden wrought. And so here again, when you combine an existing economic crisis and an economy that is teetering on the edge of really disaster. And by the way, that's not just my opinion. I mean, that is as mm-hmm. evidenced by the economic metrics that are out there, all of which declined massively. For example, you know, I mentioned the Christmas shopping season. Consumer confidence in recent months tanked to a post-World War II low per the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey, which is the gold standard of consumer sentiment, a survey that goes all the way back to the 1950s. We literally just hit the lowest point ever. So consumers are already in a terrible place, in a terrible frame of mind because of their pocketbooks, because of what Joe Biden has done to their savings and their prosperity heading into Christmas. You throw on top of this now the potential for massive supply chain disruptions because of this potential looming rail strike. And it's really just a recipe for an even deeper disaster that the American people have already had to endure with Joe Biden when it comes to the economy.
I mean, the economy is in a really tough spot. I believe that they played some games with the Fed over the summer and early fall to cushion the blow ahead of the midterms. I think that everyone knows that we're in a recession, but I think there's some games also done, obviously, with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to try to get gas prices a little more manageable. Because, Steve, this midterm election should have been much more focused on the economy than it was, right? I mean, it shouldn't be a 4-seat majority. It should be a 40-seat majority, given the economic catastrophe we're living through.
Yes. And by the way, to that point of whether or not we're in a recession, according to CNN polling, not exactly a right-wing organization, 75% of the American people say that we are in a recession right now. So the American people know this. People on Main Street, regular folks, know that we are in a recession. You know, whatever academic debates the corporate media and the White House want to engage in, the American people know where we are. They know where things are in their own lives. They know that real wages, meaning your income adjusted for the things you need to buy in your life, real wages have declined for 19 consecutive months. That is the worst streak in all of American history. You are working harder to get poorer every single month. And the American people clearly know that. To your point about the Fed, look, the Federal Reserve is every bit as complicit in creating this inflationary madness as is Joe Biden and the Congress, you know, particularly Schumer and Pelosi, all of them share in the blame here. Now, the Fed, I will at least say this to its credit, it seems to have found religion, but very conveniently, largely after the midterm election. So, for example, just this past weekend, the president of the St. Louis Fed, Bullard, made some very aggressive comments about how much the Fed needs to raise interest rates to try to rein in this inflationary madness that the Fed Fed chiefs themselves helped to create. Now, he's very late, but better late than never. And I think the Fed finally has come to grips with the crisis that they helped to create. And never forget this, too, by the way, throughout all of 2021 and even into 2022, as this inflation was becoming ever more obvious to regular Americans, to anybody paying attention, there was a consistent lie from the power brokers in Washington, D.C., from the White House, from Janet Yellen at Treasury, from Jerome Powell at the Fed, that it was, quote, transitory. That was the nonstop echoed lie. Of course, they knew it wasn't transitory. It never was. It was systemic and deeply embedded. Yet they continued that ridiculous mm-hmm. lie, that canard, for a long time. And I think, you know, to your point, largely because the Fed is incredibly politicized. And the Fed, unfortunately, particularly Jerome Powell, is most interested in the institutional yes. power of the Fed rather than trying to protect the prosperity of regular Americans.
That's right. Are you tired of feeling tired? I've never experienced anything quite like the new Strong Cell product. I take it right before every single show. It's so easy. And you've got to read up on everything that has been packed into these tiny bottles. You see, Strong Cell is a new scientific cocktail of cellular level replenishment. It's so simple. Just drink one small bottle of Strong Cell liquid per day and boom, you guys get NADH. NAD is something I've been studying for a while. And before I got to know Strong Cell, I said, boy, I really would love to take it every day. It's a crucial coenzyme for creating natural energy and restoration in your bodily cells. It also contains collagen, well documented for its vast health benefits. Your body should experience a big energy boost the first week, then within 15 days, you'll start noticing even more benefits. 30 days, you'll be feeling so much different. So do me a favor and consider giving the supplement the full 4 weeks versus just one bottle to realize the best results for you. The formula is designed to generate long-term positive change, unlike energy drinks. I take it every single day. It's not an artificial boost of immediate energy like caffeine. I'm talking about cellular level restoration. Learn more right now at their website. Visit strongcell.com/Charlie and enter promo code Charlie for a 20% discount. They have made me a believer. NAD is a real thing. You guys should check it out. My special 20% discount for Kirk Show fans will apply whether you want to test it out for 1 week or for a month. But I highly encourage you guys to try it for all 4 weeks. You won't regret it. With us is Steve Cortez. He has an amazing Substack. How do people find that, Steve?
Yes, please. Best way is go to my social media. I'm on Getter. I'm just at Steve. Very simple. I'm also still on Twitter. I say still because I barely survived there. Some of the timeouts that I was put in and suspensions. I'm at Cortez, Steve Cortez with an S, and link to my Substack through either of those.
Very good. So, Steve, one of the things that has been bothering me, and I'd love your feedback on this. How is it that Republicans messed up the economic messaging so terribly this election cycle? So what was so fascinating about some of the exit polls is how upset people are about where America is, how dissatisfied they are about the economy, and yet how, for the first time really in the last 20 years, voters had these feelings, had the ingredients for what would be a red tsunami, but they didn't do the one-to-one connection.
Right.
Why?
No, correct. So you're exactly correct. You know, voters overwhelmingly report correctly that we're in a recession, overwhelmingly give massive disapproval of Joe Biden on most issues, but particularly on the economy and inflation. And yet many of those same voters did not decide to vote for the GOP. So we have to ask the question why. I think the principal reason is that the Republican Party, the establishment Republican Party, has not earned their trust on these kinds of matters. And so there is reluctance that is very understandable. Okay. It is evidence-based reluctance. It's not just some prejudice against Republicans. It's knowing that in the past, the Republican Party, let's be honest, the Paul Ryan, Jeb Bush style Republican Party has economically worked for the interests of C-suite executives and the globalist credential class rather than on behalf of working Americans. Now, that is changing massively because of what Donald Trump has done and because at the voter level, the Republican Party has transformed into a party of working class Americans. But the reality is at the office holder level, that work is still very much ongoing. Yes. And so yes. I think voters simply, let me be specific. Let me give you an example. When voters look at the Republican Party and see that we have now sent in a time when Americans can't pay their rent, I put a chalk talk up on my social media. The latest number out of a lineable of 5,000 small businesses in America shows that 41% of them could not pay their rent in the month of November. That is a staggering number. It is a record high. 41% of small businesses can't pay the most basic bill their business has, which is the rent for their operation. At that same time, Republicans, establishment Republicans, have joined with the Democrats to send tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine to escalate a fight which has no definable U.S. national interest. And yet we are borrowing, we don't have the money, we are borrowing a mountain of money to send to Ukraine, to an incredibly corrupt country, to battle another corrupt country in an ancient ethnic war that has no ramifications if we were to just leave it alone for the national interest and certainly not for the economy of the United States. I think a lot of voters quite reasonably look at that trade-off and say, I don't believe the Republicans have my back when it comes to the kitchen table, tangible issues of the economy, and that they're most concerned about me and my prosperity. And we've got to change that.
Now, what a missed opportunity.
We have control of the House.
What a missed opportunity, right, Steve? I mean, obviously there's ballot harvesting and all that stuff. We know it. We talk about it. We're on the 100%. But it is inarguable, though, that there was some missed opportunity on the margins to win over an extra 5 to 7 to 8% of independent voters. Do you feel, Steve, in the time we have remaining, that we just thought it would happen automatically?
Sure. No, I do. I think, unfortunately, and look, maybe I'm guilty of this as well, there was too much complacency. Because I think if you looked at the political landscape, if you look at how deeply unpopular Joe Biden is, I think there was an assumption that we would do well. And, you know, you mentioned the mechanics of voting. Clearly,
yep,
we did not work smartly and hard enough on the mechanics of voting. That's going to change for 2024, particularly in the states where those mechanics are largely rigged against us, places like Pennsylvania and Arizona. So we can fix that, and we must fix that, of course. But yeah, listen, I think absolutely there was overconfidence, and we need to absolutely guard against that. But also, here's the good news. We did win the House, not by the margins we wanted,
no,
but
of
we
course.
Won the House.
Yes.
We have the lever of power now to start to convince those reluctant voters that we do have their back when it comes to these kitchen
issues. No, of course. I mean, I know this sounds silly. It could have been worse. And I know that we were just a couple notches away. I mean, you look at David Schweikert's seat. He won by like 1,400 votes. You look at Sisgamani's seat in Arizona. He won by like 2,000 votes. You look at Valadao. I mean, we're talking about 15,000 to 20,000 votes in some of these House races. Lauren Boebert, go differently. Pelosi's still Speaker. We're talking about 15 to 20,000 votes, Steve.
Right.
And so, praise God, we landed the plane in that way. But there has to be a comprehensive reevaluation. Machinery, number one, obviously, voter integrity, election integrity. But there were places where we should have done a lot better with independent and swing voters. And I think it's worthy of some examination. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. Great job.
You bet.
Check him out on Getter, at Steve. Right now, Bank of America has just lowered its 2022 forecast for the S&P 500 by a whopping 900 points to 3,600. Saying we're headed for a recession this year, it said the new year target is the lowest on the street. This is not good news for those of you stuck in equities or anything tied to stock markets. I know thousands of people who have put their trust in Noble Gold to prevent losing money in the financial storm that is brewing. You can join them by calling their expert team. Noble Gold has recently voted the number one gold company in the country by Consumer Affairs. No call centers, no scripted response, no bull, just a straight, honest run through options so you can decide. And by the way, they're giving away a beautiful 1/10 ounce gold American Eagle coin with every qualifying IRA or 401k rollover this month. You can't go wrong with Noble Gold. Call the team now at 877-646-5347 to find out more or visit noblegoldinvestments.com. That is noblegoldinvestments.com. Email us freedom@charliekirk.com and subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show podcast. Joining us now is Julie Kelly from American Greatness to go over some of the latest news when it comes to the January 6th investigation that just seems to never end. Julie, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for having me on.
So walk us through the news yesterday. It took the headlines at every major news outlet as if this was something that was very important. Someone was found guilty of seditious conspiracy. Is that warranted? Walk us through it.
So this is related to the prosecution of members of the Oath Keepers, an alleged militia group accused of trying to overthrow the government on January 6th. So this is the first trial of many. Five men stood trial, about a 6 or 7 week trial. These five men were charged with the extremely rare count of seditious conspiracy. No American has been convicted of this crime, but they were charged with seditious conspiracy after Merrick Garland was getting a lot of heat a year after January 6th for no insurrection or treason-like charges. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this went before a D.C. jury. Two of the men, Stuart Rhodes, who is the founder of the Oath Keepers, and another man, Kelly Meggs, were convicted of seditious conspiracy. Three other men were acquitted, all five men convicted of obstruction of an official proceeding. But as you could see, Charlie, the headlines were over the top crazy. This looked like the biggest win for the DOJ in, you know, 100 years or so. You had prosecutors celebrating at fancy restaurants in Washington, D.C. But this is an absurd case. It's an absurd conviction. How do you overthrow the government, Charlie, with no weapons? Two of the men never even went inside of the building. The other three who went inside actually tried reports that they tried to help police. They carried no weapons. They assaulted no one. They vandalized nothing. They walked in open doors on the east side, were there for about 25, 30 minutes and left. But this is the sort of ridiculous case that this DOJ is bringing in its vengeful retaliation against Trump and his supporters.
So two thoughts on this. I think they went out to fancy restaurants afterwards because it's really not about Stuart Rhodes. It's about the narrative, because now there's a reference point where they can say that somebody has been charged for seditious conspiracy, not charged, has been convicted for seditious conspiracy. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. So this is the long-awaited insurrection conviction that they have been waiting for. Not only that, Charlie, this is, in their belief, this brings them one step closer in justifying an indictment against Donald Trump. You saw in the statement last night made by Benny Thompson, chairman of the January 6th committee, and of course his vice president, Liz Cheney, crowing about these convictions and the rule of law, and then instantly mentioning Donald Trump. What they're going to try to do with this conviction is tie the Oath Keepers. Next month starts the trial of the Proud Boys, the two alleged militias who this committee has been fixated on, and try to tie both of those groups to Donald Trump. How they will do that with the Oath Keepers, they were providing security for Trump allies like Roger Stone and Michael Flynn in December and then on January 6th. So that, Charlie, will try to be the connection between the sedition conviction and Donald Trump. So there's a lot of ways that the media and the Democrats can spin this.
Now, second, you know, just to be make sure everyone has the full picture, what was the evidence then? Because I'm guessing, and I really haven't dug that deep into it, I'm guessing they had some rather charged text messages and or communications. Is that correct?
That is basically most of the case. Yeah. Is a lot of text messages and communications, videos posted by Stuart Rhodes, who, look, if you watch Stuart Rhodes and his videos, he's not someone that you want to hang out with, right? And he was sort of bringing these people together. He was going to events throughout 2020, trying to recruit people to provide security, not just at Stop the Steal rallies, but of course, all of these protests and demonstrations and riots going on throughout the country during 2020. So yes, the case was mostly on communications, text messages, especially Facebook posts and videos. But at the end of the day, as I said, these people walked in to a building a half an hour after Congress evacuated, open doors on the east side of the Capitol, no weapons, didn't attack anyone, didn't vandalize any property. For a half hour of being inside the Capitol, basically committing no crime, now you have two men convicted with a crime that is equals treason. And all of these people face decades in prison, even for the obstruction of an official proceeding conviction, which is a felony punishable by up to 20 years in prison.
So what sort of precedent does this then set? I mean, if you can now be charged for seditious conspiracy, I also just want to, for the record, I haven't seen all the evidence, and so if there's something that could be convinced me otherwise, then send it to me. But is the precedent now, if you have very strongly worded private communications and messages, and then you show up to a protest but don't actually do anything violent, then you could be connected with a crime against the United States. Is that right?
That's right. That is the precedent that has been set here, Charlie, and it's very alarming. Aside from that, the prosecutors argued that the conspiracy can happen instantaneously, and it can be an implicit conspiracy. Like, you're telepathically sending messages to others that day on the steps of the Capitol. They weren't even arguing that this was a conspiracy months in the making. And of course, unfortunately, what this trial did not expose is the numerous FBI informants we know were run into that group months before January 6th, including the man who was the vice president of the organization. He was supposed to testify. He suffered some health event, I think a heart attack, on it before he traveled to DC to testify. The jury never heard from him. But look, this is a problem that is hopefully will be exposed under a Republican Congress, Charlie. Everyone deserves to know exactly how many FBI informants were in these groups, who they communicated with, and one of two things. Did they provoke the events of that day, or did they collect the intelligence about January 6th and never pass it on? Those are some of the larger questions that loom, especially after this trial.
Or how about who planted the pipe bombs? Mm-hmm. We don't know. Almost 2 years.
Everyone forgot about that.
Yeah, that would be more than seditious conspiracy, right? That would be Timothy McVeigh type stuff if the bombs actually worked. Praise God they didn't. So Julie, I want to connect something that you said here about how they're trying to draw a line to Trump. Can you just kind of give an update, because it's very murky in the media and hard to track? If you were wargaming this in Trump's inner circle, what would you say is the greatest posing legal threat against him? Not legitimate, but where do you think, if they're going to try to take the quote-unquote their shot, where do you think it's going to come from? Is it going to be January 6th? Is it going to be the memorabilia? Is it going to be Fulton County? Or do you think there's a chance they're just going to go for all of it?
I think in terms of DOJ and what's happening in D.C., what I believe and have said for months is that he will be indicted on conspiracy and or obstruction of an official proceeding. So this obstruction charge, we've already seen numerous convictions and plea deals. This is a felony that dates back to the post-Enron era. It was originally passed and signed by George W. Bush to prevent tampering with evidence that we saw in the Enron investigation. What's happened, Charlie, is this DOJ has bastardized this felony to basically now criminalize, make into a felon, anyone who interrupts any sort of government proceeding, which a lot of people think is, you know, our birthright, that's the time to protest. I mean, we've seen, you know, we could go through the list of protests, especially in Washington, where official congressional business is disrupted by protesters. They usually get a slap on the wrist and they go home. That's not the case with January 6th. So they are setting another precedent here that's very dangerous. But I do think these are the two charges that Donald Trump will face. And I believe that these convictions yesterday only bolster the government's way of convincing a grand jury that Donald Trump is guilty and should go to trial for conspiring with these groups and others to attack the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. But I don't think that's a strong case. But a D.C. jury... I mean, there will be a competition to try to be part of that jury, to be part of the person to indict, to convict Trump. I'm sorry, I got to get my language precise. To convict Trump, I mean, the district voted 96% against him. Now, that if Trump's lawyers, who are savvy, that's a good argument to a judge to get a change of venue. I don't know if they'll get one, but it's not even you're going to have people on the jury that almost guaranteed cast the ballot against the man if this ends up going that far. So 30 seconds, and then I'd love to have you for another segment, Julie. Do you think that it is then very likely, almost certainly, Donald Trump will be indicted by Mr. Jack Smith in the coming months, if not year?
I absolutely do. And to your point, Charlie, it is a grand jury made up of these same people will be considering indictments against Donald Trump. And I've seen these DC grand juries sign off on the most absurd charges, including seditious conspiracy. So they have no filter either. And unfortunately, these judges have no handle. They are a rubber stamp for the DOJ. And to your point, have refused every change of venue motion made in every single case.
So there is a rumored January 6th report that is going to be issued soon. It seems as if, according to some of the more accurate reporting, the people that I trust, this is really going to be focused on Trump. It seems to be a Trump 2024 derailment strategy. Is that right?
It is, Charlie. And that is what's been so interesting about some recent reporting about this final report, which is now, I believe, on its fifth delay. This report was supposed to be issued in the middle of September. It was moved to October, two dates in November. Now I think we're on our second date in December. And it looks like the reason why is there's internal conflict because Liz Cheney, of course, wants this report to solely focus on Donald Trump, place blame at his feet, explain why he was responsible. Apparently, there were people who thought this was a legitimate investigation. There's an entire team assigned to looking at law enforcement's response, their foreknowledge, their lack of preparation, and the intelligence agencies apparently that failed to detect what this insurrection to the extent that that's true. So there's a lot of conflict now. Some staffers have actually quit the committee in protest of focusing only on Donald Trump in this report. So there's a little spin now, a little damage control coming out by people like Adam Schiff saying, oh, no, we're going to address all the issues. But look, we could tell by the televised performances, the witnesses that this committee has dragged out in front of the public. This had nothing to do with really investigating what led up to the events of January 6th and what happened that day. Most Americans who still see this as an organic event, not an inside job, really want to know how the FBI and local law enforcement failed, how the Capitol Police failed, why they weren't protected, why they let people in at certain vantage points. We have that on film. We know that that's true. But all of that, it looks like for now, is going to be scuttled while they attempt to blame Donald Trump and say that he is not eligible for office again under the 14th Amendment. And that's what the purpose of this report appears like it's going to be.
Yeah, and it seems like an all-out blitz and legal strategy. And President Trump is now an active candidate, which then seemed to trigger, in Garland's calculation, the appointment of Jack Smith, a special counsel, which timeline-wise, you got to think a lot of the work is already done, though, right?
Sure.
I don't think – usually a special counsel is like, okay, now we're going to start the process to look into. I think this is kind of more of a face and a name and a lead – person to bring this to trial.
I think that that's probably right. What more evidence could they collect about January 6th? Who else could they possibly interview? Unless Jack Smith is going to do what Robert Mueller did, and that is drag one Trump associate after another before his investigation, including Republican lawmakers. You know, it's one thing to defy a subpoena from this hack committee that isn't even living up to its originating legislation. It's another to defy a subpoena from a special counsel, prosecutor tasked and appointed by the Department of Justice, which I'm assuming Jack Smith will do. But look, there's another big question here, and that is the 1,000-plus transcripts of interviews that this committee has conducted over the past year and a half. What's going to happen with those transcripts? We've been told the committee would make those public. It doesn't look like that's the case. My expectation is all of these transcripts are going to be buried at Jack Smith's office. The defense attorneys cannot see them for possible exculpatory evidence for their clients. The public will not be able to see it. Donald Trump and his lawyers won't be able to see it. We already see that happening with the classified documents. No one has seen this, including Trump and his attorneys. It's buried at DOJ, which is exactly what they try to do with all of this evidence while they spin in the media that this is what it's about. So the next few weeks leading up to January 3rd are going to be very interesting with Smith's special counsel, also what this committee ends up doing. And my expectation is that this report is going to land like a thud, and there's going to be a lot of conflicts with legally with the information they've collected and now are hiding in criminal trials away from defendants and their defense attorneys.
If they indict Trump, it's very important. His lawyers say, get out of D.C. I'm not sure they're going to get a venue change requested. But if there is ever a robust argument that a fair mind could say, you know, you probably are not going to get a fair hearing, it would be Donald Trump on trial in Washington, D.C. And I mean, anywhere. I mean, you could go to Cincinnati and you could pick a better venue. But it's they know what they're doing. They venue shop. And boy, Washington, D.C. would be fertile ground against Trump. Okay, Julie, great job. Check out American Greatness, amgreatness.com. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.